You're listening to a podcast from 702.
You're with Clement Magnatella.
702. Let's walk the talk.
It's 25 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We are going to get an update on what's happening in Afghanistan. This past weekend, we commemorated 20 years since the 9/11 terror attacks on the US. This while Afghanistan is coming to terms with the Taliban takeover since the US pulled its troops out 20 years after it went in to punish those who planned and executed those terror attacks. I'm going to be joined now by Doctors Without Borders. I want us to talk about the role of humanitarian aid and how they've been able to offer humanitarian aid during such a tricky period, and how do they remain neutral in a situation like that. And then 15 minutes later, I'll bring in Yvonne Ridley, who's a British journalist who was captured by the Taliban. I want us to reflect on the new government that's been announced. I want us to reflect on the time when she was abducted and what her thoughts are around what's happened over the last couple of weeks since the Taliban took over. But let's start this discussion with Kirsten Noko, who is the field worker for MSF Southern Africa, currently working in Kunduz in Afghanistan. Kirsten, thank you so much for making time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Clement, and thanks for having us, and greetings to all your listeners.
How are things there at the moment?
Things are getting a little bit calm after a very difficult few months. Conflict has been in Afghanistan for close to 40 years now. So indeed, there's been waves of violence and waves of relative peace. And I would say that we are currently enjoying that, if I can call it that, a wave of relative peace and calm, but things are still very difficult after all the trauma that people went through in the last wave of violence.
Mm. And how has that affected you, that the last wave of violence and what's been happening in Afghanistan? How has your role as humanitarian organizations been impacted?
So just maybe to explain a little bit on what it is that we're doing, and then try to explain what the current wave or the last few months have been like for us. So MSF provides, or Doctors Without Borders provides, life-saving medical care in Afghanistan, just like we do in many other countries in the world. We have been working in Afghanistan since 1979. We are currently working in five hospitals spread across the country, with the sixth one that was forced to close after yet another attack on a hospital that happened in May of 2020 in Kabul. And in the last few months, what has been extremely difficult and it's things that have almost always been very difficult. We are currently facing problems with, supplies being able to reach our hospitals. You can imagine that in a place that has been at war for the past 40 years, give or take, it is very difficult to find medical supplies. And I talk about drugs and all other medical equipment that we need in the different hospitals, but also logistical supplies. You think about fuel for the cars and the ambulances to run the generators, because electricity and load shedding, load shedding is quite a common occurrence as well. In the last wave of violence also now, actually in the past few weeks, one of the most difficult things has been the collapse almost of the financial system. Banks are closing down. In actual fact, we got a call from our bank in our city that we use to pay people who are working in our hospital. They called us yesterday to let us know that they are closing shop. Mm. So the bank is closing, and it's the only bank that we have in the city. Mm. So things are getting quite difficult. So, of course, next week is the end of the month, and people are expecting their salaries. So you can imagine all sorts of things that that are becoming more and more difficult as the uncertainty continues, and as the changes sort of take effect in the
country. Mm-hmm. How do you go about, you know, giving that humanitarian aid? Because I imagine it may be tricky in that you don't want to be seen to be taking sides, obviously. And I know you've always prided yourself and you've been guided by the principles of neutrality, the independence and impartiality. Do you treat, whether you are member of the Taliban that's been injured, you treat those people, whether they're from the other side, or... And also, how does it work even with funding? Do you get funding from governments that may be seen to be anti or sympathetic to the Taliban? How does it work around that to ensure that you maintain your neutrality?
Yeah, thanks for the question again. I mean, as you rightly say, it's a very difficult situation to deal with, especially in an active conflict zone. So what we try to do as Doctors Without Borders is to try and ensure that when we provide assistance, medical care in this instance, it is in an impartial way. So we don't really, we are not concerned about a patient ease. So if you come with a bullet wound, for example, we don't care who caused the bullet wound and who you were fighting. For us, that is not our business. And this is how, for example, last year, so in 2020, we provided over 5,600 surgical interventions in the country. And we don't know who these people are fighting for and against. Because what we consider as a humanitarian organization is that our assistance has to be impartial. And in trying to do that, we try to be guided by humanitarian principles and in the pursuit of impartiality. And one of these is firstly neutrality. So as I say, we don't take sides between the people who are fighting or amongst the people who are fighting. In the case of Afghanistan, where you had numerous people fighting all at the same time. But also what we do is we try to be independent in our decision making. So this is both in terms of independence, in terms of financial independence, but also operational independence. What I mean by this is that when we decide that we want to work in a particular hospital, that is informed purely on the medical needs. So we don't work there because, I don't know, Clement from 702 asked us to work in this because this is his community. It doesn't matter for us how powerful or how many guns Clement has or how much territory he controls. What we try to do is to be guided by the medical needs.
Yeah.
And also linked to independence is the financial independence. So what we do is in specific instances, working in conflict zones, we only accept private funding. I'm sure some of your listeners have seen some of our teams around shopping malls in Johannesburg and in other parts of South Africa, asking people to sign up, donating what is relatively small amounts of money for the work that we have to do here. Mm. But through the efforts, we are able to have the financial means to make independent decisions on where we are working instead of working on the advice or instructions of different donor countries who normally provide humanitarian funding.
Has this approach always protected you as Doctors Without Borders, Akustin? Because I remember, was it in 2015 that the U.S. Special Forces bombed your hospital in Kunduz?
Yes, indeed, as you rightly say, it does not always work. I think after the hospital, so the last hospital that we had in Kunduz was bombed in 2015, we received a lot of public support from the communities around Southern Africa, but also around the world. And we know that this this way of working is not always foolproof. So it doesn't always work. But because we know, for example, I mean, we have suffered security incidents ourselves. We have lost colleagues, not only in Kunduz, but also just in May of 2020, which is about 18 months ago, we also had patients dying after yet another hospital was attacked. According to the WHO, what we know is that for 2020, Afghanistan reported the highest number of attacks against health facilities in the world. So yes, when we look at it, we are working in a place where there's a lot of violence, and we are not really expecting to be exempt or an exception to all of this. But what we try to do is we believe that by talking to the people and talking to all the people who are involved, that does provide us with some sort of assurances. We are able to negotiate with the people and explain what it is that we are doing. As you can imagine, after all these years of conflict, one of the net effects of conflict in societies is that the very fiber of society is broken. So trust is very difficult. So unless and until we're able to go to people, talk to them and find out what their medical needs are, explain what it is that we can do and we cannot do, then we believe that this dialogue does protect, or at least does provide us with some sort of assurances. But as I say, it's never a guarantee that nothing will happen.
Yeah, look, you guys are brave out there, Kirsten. Thank you so much for speaking to us. Kirsten Noko is a field worker for MSF Southern Africa, currently working in Afghanistan. He's with Doctors Without Borders. How brave is that, right? When people are walking away and leaving Afghanistan, humanitarian aid stays, because they see the need and they want to help and offer these services that are needed in many communities in that country. It's 14 minutes now before 11 o'clock. After the break, I'm going to speak to Yvonne Ridley, who was captured by the Taliban in 2001. She'll tell us how it was and what her reflections are on this political force that's now taken over Kabul. It's 13 now before 11.
Let's walk the talk.
This is Clemens Maniatella
on 702.
It's 12 minutes before 11 o'clock. We are reflecting on the takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban. And we spoke earlier to Doctors Without Borders and how their work as a humanitarian organization has been impacted by the latest developments. I want us to reflect on the Taliban now, and even with what they've announced. I think a couple of days ago they announced their new government. I was looking at pictures. They did promise that women will still be allowed to go to school, even though during their previous rule they were not. And I was looking at pictures yesterday of, you know, school children, like, but women are now separated by a curtain from men, so they're allowed to go to school, but they are separated from the men. I want us to bring into this conversation now Yvonne Ridley, who was actually captured by the Taliban back in 2001. Yvonne, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for making time.
Thank you for inviting me.
What happened in 2001 when you were taken captive?
Well, I was held for 11 days, partly in Jalalabad and then in a prison in Kabul. And it was an absolutely terrifying experience because, you know, I was convinced that this was an evil, brutal regime that hated women. And so I didn't give myself very good odds of surviving the ordeal. But bizarrely enough, throughout the entire time, I was treated with courtesy and respect, which I didn't appreciate in the moment because I felt as though this was just treacherous behavior, an act of subterfuge to lull me into a false sense of security before they did whatever dark deeds I thought they were going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of other things that they've done to the people that they had kept captive and how they've treated them, you know, the public executions, etc. Did they explain to you why they captured you? Did they think you're some form of some kind of a spy or anything?
Well, I had entered the country without a visa and passport. I'd sneaked in wearing the all-enveloping burqa, and they thought I was some sort of super US G.I. Jane type character, because they didn't understand my northern accent from the borders in England and Scotland. And of course, you know, we don't all talk like the Queen. But what I will acknowledge, I think there was obviously a lot of white privilege at play here, in as much as I was probably treated much better than Afghan women would be. So I do, you know, I have to realize that.
How have you been reflecting when you saw over a month or so ago that they have now taken over Kabul and the US is now leaving Afghanistan? What are your reflections? What were you thinking when this story was developing a month ago?
Well, the only thing that surprised me was the chaotic departure, retreat, whatever you want to call it, of the US troops. It was something quite astonishing to witness. I wasn't surprised at the Taliban comeback. At the end of the day, they are ordinary Afghan people. They have as much love and passion for their country as anyone else. And they made that quite clear during the 11 days I was held, that they would never give up Afghanistan without a fight. They didn't want to fight with the Americans. They also made that very clear as well. But they said if it happened, then, you know, they would never give up their country. So I came to know in 11 days what America and Britain have, you know, it's taken them 20 years to discover. And, you know, you have to question the motive of what has to be one of the most futile wars in history.
What do you think of what Afghanistan has in store for Afghans? I mean, you experienced them, the Taliban, differently in 11 days. As you've indicated, there are other people that have experienced the worst, you know, at the hands of the Taliban. Do you think? Do you think that they will live up to the promises that they have made now as this mature political force that is not going to be strictly implementing, you know, the laws that were really the basis during their time when they governed Afghanistan? Do you believe them? Do you think they've changed and they're more mature?
I think they have changed. I think they are more mature, but there is still way to go in terms of the promises that they made at that historic press conference when, you know, they promised an inclusive government which would reflect the diversity of Afghanistan. The only comfort I could take from the announcement of the interim government was the word interim. And, you know, hopefully they will make good on the promises that they made at the press conference. But, you know, the Taliban didn't invent Afghan culture. And that is that should be understood by the outside world, that quite often what we see as being Taliban behavior is actually Afghan culture, which has been around for centuries. And so, you know, I think the West would be wrong to walk away. I think that we need to do what we should have done in the first place, which is give support, help when needed, and without strings attached. You know, we can't force our sort of democracy, our sort of lifestyle on a people who don't want it.
Yeah. You were a Christian at the time of the capture in 2001, and then you converted to Islam. And I'm interested to know what was behind that. In fact, there's one of our listeners who sent us a message as well on this. Yunus says, hi, please can you ask Yvonne whether it was precisely the humane treatment she received from the Taliban during captivity that led her to convert to Islam?
Well, you know, I was in there for 11 days, and it as I say, it was terrifying. In fact, I remembered reading something that Steve Biko once said, which was that the greatest weapon of the oppressor is the oppressed mind. And I, you know, my mind was working overtime about what was going to happen, in fact, instead of what was actually happening. But during those 11 days, what I did come to realize was that Islam is a way of life. It's not something that you pick up on a Friday and put down. And I was a practicing Christian, and I did have this core belief in God. So I was quite interested from a religious aspect about their behavior and how they could, but it was then that I realized that Islam was a way of life. They did invite me to embrace Islam, and I said I couldn't make such a life-changing decision while I was in prison, but if they let me go, I promised to read the Quran and study Islam, which is exactly what I did when I left. And it was more really of an academic exercise, because I thought, how can I write with any authority about the Muslim world if I don't know anything about Islam? And that's what set me off reading. And what was an academic exercise, and I guess the fulfillment of a promise in some ways, very quickly turned into a spiritual journey for me. And it resonated for me. It wasn't a huge leap of faith. I'm still praying to the same God. I'm just doing it in a different way.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating, Yvonne. And thank you so much for sharing that with us. When they invited you to convert to Islam, was it just a mere friendly invite? Or, like, in other words, did you have an option, so to speak?
Yes. As I said, you know, I can't make such a decision while I'm in prison. And, you know, I just seized on this opportunity. I mean, if they'd asked me to learn Swahili, I would have said, yes, I'll do it. You know, I just wanted to get out. And while they held on to other Westerners, they did release me. So, as I say, you know, 2 years after studying Islam, I converted. Of course, the Taliban would claim my scalp, so to speak, and or spirit, and say, right, you know, that's down to us. But, you know, in all fairness, they were the trigger. They did set me off on this journey. But I don't think they or I, in our wildest dreams, would have imagined where it would end. I said before, you know, I was a practicing Christian. I wasn't looking to change my faith. I was very happy with my life. I wasn't looking for anything else. I was quite satisfied with the way things were going. So it's, you know, I can understand how people do find the change bizarre. But, you know, since the horrific events of 9/11, Islam has become the fastest growing religion in the world, because people like me got curious, thinking, what on earth is in this book that would promote death and destruction on the scale of what we saw on 9/11?
Oh, well, that's fascinating, Yvonne. I really, really thank you for making time to chat to me. It's always great to hear from the people that have actually interacted as well with the Taliban, and not just, you know, take it from just the one side and the perspective of, you know, other people or the Western. So thank you so much for making time. I really appreciate it. Yvonne Ridley was captured by the Taliban in 2001. She's actually written a book about it. You can go check out the videos. She's done a lot of work around it. She's written about it extensively. So you can go and check that